purchase. The first bicycle had given to Hardy. They didn't know how much it weighed, it was just the hand part. They put it up in the new student center and it pulled off the wall. They didn't attach it right.
Okay, so we are back. I apologize for the issue with the audio. We'll try to do better at that. I did start an audio recording independent of the video.
So, oh, Mike told me when it went off.
So anyway, we'll get back into that in just a second here. So where we were looking was in Romans chapter 1. We're about to look at that passage and we realized the mic wasn't recording. So Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated to the gospel of God, which he promised before through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures. Doesn't say which prophets, it just said prophets. Well, let me encourage you to turn to Acts. And in the book of Acts, in the 10th chapter, we see the circumstances under which Peter and Cornelius got together. I'm not going to read through all that. Cornelius had a vision. Peter had a vision. The Lord's bringing both of them together. Here's an example of providence functioning. And so Peter meets Cornelius in his household, and he's going to begin to teach him. And so if you drop down to verse 34, we're going to survey quickly what Peter says to Cornelius until we get to the point we want to look at. So he says, in truth I perceive that God shows no partiality. There's verse 34. Every nation, whoever fears God, works righteousness, they're going to be accepted. Notice every nation. So we've already noticed that Isaiah is going to accentuate the sovereignty of God over all nations. And that's something that's been anticipated from the beginning. Genesis chapter 12, the covenant was not just going to bless Abraham's descendants directly, but everybody through Abraham and Abraham's descendants. So that principle of everyone that works righteousness is going to be accepted is everywhere in the text. Incidentally, I don't want to get off track here, but it's very much related. Jesus went out of his way to demonstrate a principle of inclusiveness with reference to all peoples. The Samaritans were often the heroes. He healed the Syrophoenician woman, even though she said, the food is for the children and the dogs are going to be fed later. He wasn't trying to insult her. He's just indicating his purpose. She said, yeah, but even when the cubs drop from the table, the dogs get to eat. And he realized she was a person of faith. When Jesus was speaking in the synagogue in Nazareth in Luke chapter 4, he picked up and he read from the book of Isaiah, by the way, and he says, this day this prophecy is fulfilled in your hearing. And he goes on a little bit later, people are trying to figure out, how can this guy know what he knows? He's not a literate person. Where'd he go to school, so to speak? And so Jesus begins to give some illustrations that really kind of set them off. First, he said, during the days of Elijah, there were many widows, but only the widow of Zarephath, not a Jew, did he help. During the days of Elisha, his successor, there were many lepers, but the only one that was healed was Naaman, a Syrian commander, not a Jew. And the Jews were ready to kill him when he said that. What's his point? Well, salvation has never been a Jewish-only thing. It's a through the Jews, but not to the Jews thing. And so in this context, he's saying, this is the principle that God has always taught. Of a truth, I say, God's not any respecter of people, of faces, of persons, but in every nation. That's, Isaiah is going to talk about sovereignty of God. So notice the word which God sent to the children of Israel, preaching peace through Jesus Christ. He is Lord of all. That word you know, which was proclaimed throughout all Judea and began from Galilee after the baptism which John preached. So talking about all the stuff that that Jesus is going to do. We're witnesses of all of these things, of what he did in the land of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They killed him, verse 39. God raised him up. On the third day, showed him openly, not to all the people, but to witnesses chosen before by God. And he commanded us to preach to the people and to testify that it is he who is ordained by God to be the judge of the living and the dead. Now watch verse 43. To him all the prophets witness that through his name, whoever believes in him will receive remission of sins. So yes, Isaiah is definitely the larger of the books of prophecy, and he's often referred to as the messianic prophet. But in some way, all of the prophets referred to Jesus coming. Moses, we don't often think of as a prophet, but he calls himself a prophet. He says, a prophet like unto me, him shall God raise up, Deuteronomy. And so all the prophets, so as we're reading through Isaiah, though we're concentrating on the message and the way Isaiah is structured and the message that Isaiah delivers, what we're saying about Isaiah is not so exclusively Isaiah-centric that it doesn't apply to other prophets as well. And I'm not saying that everything in Isaiah applies to all of them, but much of it does. So that's pretty much what I want to hit on from the standpoint of where we're going in the class. And it seems a little bit discombobulated because there are 1,000 things that you can draw together that all come into play with reference to who Isaiah is and what Isaiah has done. I've got a little bit of weakness in my throat. I had some sinus congestion and infection the last week or so, and it's not always gone. So occasionally I act like I can't breathe. It's not that I can't breathe. It's just the congestion doesn't help my breathing any at all. So when I'm home, I'm doing the sinus rinses all day long. So I can't do that now, so I apologize. So I'll drink some water along the way. So very quickly, go to the webpage that I mentioned before, that I've sent you in the emails, and everything that we're going to do, the video and the audio and everything, will be recorded and will be posted there later. To get in touch with me, just send an email to me at the addresses that I'm sending, just Jody, J-O-D-Y, at thebible.net. And if you would, use that heading when you send me a message. It's not like I won't see your message if you don't use that heading, but I grab every one of those messages and I drop them in a folder and they all stay in the same place. So I know anything that's coming from anybody that's in the class, that's what it's going to be about. So let's talk about some of the mechanics, and I don't want to focus a lot on this. We'll do more next time. I want to get our feet wet into the study of the Old Testament generally and Isaiah specific as we have time, and we'll talk about the mechanics of what we're going to do in the class later. There aren't any required texts outside of Isaiah. Isaiah, I think, obviously is a required text, but you don't have to buy any commentaries. I would recommend, and this is not because it's the best one, but it's because it's one of the most accessible. And what I mean by accessible is that it's easily digested. It's probably written on a high school junior senior level. It's not an academic commentary, but Homer Haley's commentary in the Book of Isaiah, I think it's still in print. If you find one that's for $300 for sale on Amazon, don't buy that. That's probably a first edition one that somebody's trying to make a lot of money off of. But you can usually pick one up, a hardback one that's maybe, I think it was initially published in the 80s. But if you find one that's used, it would be worth your while. And I'm not going to say you have to have it, and I'm not going to refer to it directly in the class. But from the standpoint of a popular text, I think it would be good. Later, I will add an extended bibliography of all kinds of things that you might use. Most of the material that I use now is digital, and so, you know, I've invested enough to buy a couple of small cars in digital software over the last 10 years. And so, but I will make reference to references along the way, and I will post those on the page. Anything that I do that I'm going to present in class that you're going to see on the screen in the class or that you're going to have access to, when you're sitting in and watching the videos, it will all be posted online. So more about that later. So today's the 16th of September. We're going to meet 3 times this month. In October, we'll meet 3 times. Notice there's a class meeting that skipped on the 20th. I made a mistake. I just see that. There's a class on the 7th, 14th, and not the 21st. I'll change that. Class number 6 should say October the 28th. And so that's a week off. I'll fix that and post it later. But I have to speak in a meeting at the Meridianville congregation north of Huntsville in October, so there will be no class then. And as I understand it, there's not going to be class. What Mike told me was during Thanksgiving week. And so those 2 dates. So other than that, those are the class meetings, and I'll fix the one that says October 21st, that should be the 28th. And I'll find out later about everybody that's taking the class for credit. but I believe we needed 33 or 34 hours total class time. So we have 11 meetings scheduled, so we may sneak in a half an hour here or there, or I may post extra stuff to bring everybody up to speed. But we should be done by the 9th. If necessary, we may spend some time on the 16th, but hopefully I'll work in some extra material and videos along the way so that we don't have to do that. But that's the class scheduling for now. All right, so let me encourage you to put that away. And for those who are in the class, we're going to look at a chart that I had up on the screen before. And those of you who are looking at the online material, there's a chart called Bible Period Chart, and I think it's the second handout. So if you go to the web page, the second handout is going to have a Bible Period Chart. And what are we going to do with this? Well, it surveys all of Old Testament history leading up to the time of the New Testament, and then it has a couple of segments at the very end. And I want us to become familiar just with the general flow of what's going on historically speaking. And so if you find that Bible period chart, I'm not looking at it immediately here. I can go to it. So I think it's handout number 2. Yeah, so the syllabus is number 1, and it's handout number 2, so I'm going to go the access. So when you go to thebible.net/GSOP/Lowercase Isaiah-2019-Buford, Buford with a capital B, the second item there is handout, HO stands for number 2, handout number 2, Bible period chart. So if you would turn to that while I'm referring to it in the class, that would be helpful. So anything I present in the class, you will have access to online. And then I will try to, next week, I've not used Zoom before, monkeyed around with a little bit, I've used some other things, but I will be able to do screen sharing from this point forward, so you will actually see it when I'm looking at it on the computer, as well as it being displayed in the class. So if you look at this chart, there are 4 columns, left, and then the larger one, and then 2 smaller ones on the right. The left column is the name of a period. I'm going to run through those quickly. These are just an easy way to historically develop all of time from the time of creation up until the time of the church kingdom. So the first one is antediluvian. Ante meaning before. Antebellum means before the war. Antediluvian means before the flood. And so I'm not going to look at everything in the time events covered, the larger section, but the 2 bold words are the start and the finish of the name of the period on the left. So the antediluvian age, which is the period before the flood, goes back to the start of the creation, and it ends with the flood. And so where it ends is the starting point for the next period. So it says creation, flood, and then underneath that it says flood, call of Abraham. So there's a connecting point all the way down. So there's a link historically. And so that's by design, so it's easy for us to trace those things. So I'm not going to read everything else under time and events and dates in related books. I'm just going to fixate on those left columns and then those bolded words. Post-diluvian is obviously after the flood. So when the flood's done, up to the call of Abraham. So that's going to be through chapter 11. Abraham's introduced at the very tail end. His relatives are there. And then he becomes the preeminent figure starting in chapter 12. So that's the period after the flood. Now, let me just mention this, that the ages that are mentioned on the left aren't anywhere near broken up into equal blocks of time. All right? This is just to make you think here. First, if when I teach Old Testament classes, especially Genesis to Deuteronomy, I don't like to teach one book. I like to teach all 5 of them together, because that's what they're intended to be, is studied all together. So think about Genesis very quickly. Genesis covers the period before the flood. It covers the period after the flood. It's going to cover the patriarchal period and the Egyptian period. And that's the Egyptian period when they first go into the land of Egypt. That's primarily the story of Joseph. So if you look all the way on the right-hand side, it says what books are related? Genesis, 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 Genesis for the first several periods of time. Why? Because Genesis is prequel to a bigger story. Let me explain that. Is the creation a big deal? Yeah. But God's record from Genesis to Deuteronomy focuses mostly on the recreation of a special people to lead to the Messiah, more so than it does the physical creation. So what can God do that's bigger than creation? Not bigger in the sense of more expansive and more miraculous, but the creation wasn't created to be redeemed in the sense that mankind was created to be redeemed. Creation is the vehicle in which we, as part of God's creation, exist, in which we live. So if you look at Exodus through Deuteronomy, technically, most of that, all four of those books, deals with 40 years. And Genesis spans thousands of years. So you have four huge books that deal with 40 years, and one book that deals with thousands of years, and only snippets of that. And so when you get into the book of Genesis, if you want to be consistent, most of the book of Genesis is focusing on the Joseph story. Why? Because the Joseph story is how the Abrahamic promise that's mentioned in Genesis 12, repeated in Genesis 15, it's how it becomes fulfilled by means of God's providence. And so Joseph dominates. So my point is, the ages on the left-hand side are not equivalent from the standpoint of every one of them is 10 years or 100 years or 1,000 years. They're all different spans of time. So the antediluvian, creation to the flood, post-diluvian, flood to the call of Abraham. And then we get into the period of the patriarchs. And we often refer to the patriarchs exclusively as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There were more. All right. From the best information we have, the book of Job was probably took place during the period of patriarchy. How do we know that? Because there's no reference to the Old Testament law. There are sacrifices offered, but sacrifices took place from the Garden of Eden, from Genesis chapter 4 forward. And so the point is that may have been a text that was also written in that time. So I have Job in the upper right-hand corner, question mark, because that may have been the time. So the call of Abraham to the time of Joseph. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are the three great patriarchs, and God's often referred to as the God of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not to mean there were no other patriarchs, but those are the key ones. And then we get to the Egyptian period, and that's where Joseph is sold into slavery because of the jealousy of his brothers. He was the favorite child of his father, and he was sold into slavery. And by means of God's protecting him there, he was eventually the means by which the fledgling nation of Israel went into the land of Egypt, and they grew during the time that they were there. So there are a lot of dramatic things that are taking place, and I have another chart that I've started developing. This one is historical, this one is time-sensitive, the other one is redemptive. So imagine a whole nother chart, or a whole nother segment of a chart, it's too much to fit on here, this is already very small print, in which each one of these areas in time events covered, and the name of the period, all focused on specific redemptive events that take place in each one of them. Only some of which is here. There's a redemptive event in Genesis chapter 3 because sin occurs. Well, you say, that's not a redemptive event. That's a going to hell event. Well, I'm not trying to be funny. My point is, it set in motion the plan of redemption. Because in the immediate context of that sin occurring, there's a plan already introduced in Genesis 3:15. It's often referred to as a proto-evangelium, which means the first gospel, because there's a hint of the good news that's going to come later. And so in the very context of the book of Genesis, when sin's introduced, there's already a solution in play. And it's not like God came up with it on the spot. Ephesians chapter 3, verse 8 and following says that it was part of God's eternal plan to have a redemptive plan. Jesus is the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. The more particulars we could get into. But this is only partial. This is historical. This is sequence. This happened, this happened, this happened. People, places, events. The other chart, when I finish that, will be redemptive oriented. So let's look at the Egyptian period. That takes place from the time that Joseph goes into Egypt, and eventually the rest of the family comes there, and they're there, and Joseph dies, another pharaoh rises who doesn't know Joseph, and then eventually God's going to raise up a leader. Now let me make a point that I mentioned before I want to touch on. If I teach Old Testament classes, Genesis through Deuteronomy, I prefer to teach them all at once, or at least in a series of classes, so you get everything. If you open the book of Exodus, depending on what translation you look at, it's going to start with the word and or now. Almost every translation I've ever looked at. And so in the Hebrew language, it starts with what's called the vav consecutive, which is like the word and. And so if you look at the book of Exodus, it's kind of like what Luke does. when Luke gets to the end of the book of Luke chapter 24, exactly where he ends in Luke 24 is where Acts chapter 1 starts. What's the point? They were intended to be part 1 and part 2 of the same story. So I don't like to teach Luke unless I can teach Acts. And I don't like to teach Acts unless I can teach Luke first, because they're intended to be part 1 and part 2 of the same story. So my translation says, now these are. But some of them will say, and these are the names of the children of Israel. What's the point? Exactly where Genesis ends is where Exodus takes up. It's intended to be the second part of the story. And the bigger part of the story is what God's going to do, creating this nation that he's going to bring out of the land of Egypt and bring to the land of Palestine, the land of Canaan. And why it's a bigger story is because so much more time is devoted to that. And so God created the world as the vehicle in which all these things are going to take place. He created the seed line from Eve, going through through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, through Joseph, ultimately leading to the nation of Israel and the 12 sons and the 12 tribes. He did all of that as a redemptive plan that's going to ultimately lead to Christ. And Isaiah, when we get there in just a little bit, is part of that ongoing redemptive plan. Again, too much information to squeeze in here, but there's a redemptive flow. You may have heard illustrations before that there's a crimson thread that runs through Scripture, that there's a blood line that runs through Scripture. It ends with the blood of Christ, but it starts with seed line all the way down. And so that's an incredible lesson in and of itself. So God sees the oppression of the children of Israel. Exodus chapter 2, verse 23 and following says God remembered the covenant. Remember the promise that he made with Abraham. And he never forgot it. It was going to come in a certain time. Now, providentially, there are lots of other things going on. When you read about what's going on in the land of Canaan, in the context of the book of Genesis, it will talk about people who are living there. And it says these people were wicked, and that God's people aren't going to go there yet, because it says, this is interesting, because the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full. What's that about? It's a timing issue. It's a timing issue. So one of the things that we're going to get into, we've already mentioned timing issues with reference to prophets, and this is just exciting. When you get into the life of Christ, sometimes Jesus told people, don't say anything. Why not? Well, first, he didn't want demons to say anything, because they're not the best advertisement. All right? Generally speaking, you don't want somebody who's slobbering drunk, lying in the gutter, to be advertising whatever liquor you're trying to sell. That's not a good advertisement. So all the advertisements promoting that stuff have young, handsome, virile people. They all looking handsome and beautiful and whatever. And so you want to put your best foot forward. So once a demon's exorcised, this guy that he healed when he was in the area of the Gadarenes, he wanted to follow Jesus everywhere. And Jesus said, no, you go and tell your people. So he sent him to Decapolis. So sometimes he told people, sometimes he told them not to say anything. But there's some times when the text will say, because his time was not ready yet. What's the significance of that? Well, Galatians says Jesus was born of a woman, born under the law, during the fullness of times. There was a time factor that was coming into play. There was a time factor as to why so much time elapsed between the covenant that was given to Abraham and the time when the children of Israel were going to go into captivity and when they're going to be drawn out. And it involved not only what God was doing for them and with them, but it also involved what was going on in the other nations. So the Amorites' iniquity wasn't full yet. What's the point of that? There's a passage in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, says the long-suffering of God is salvation. What does that mean? Every moment that God allows us to live is another moment we can be right in God's sight. And if we're not right, we can get right. And if we are right, we can stay right. Well, that's not the way most people think about time, that God has given them another day to be what God wants them to be. But that's the way God looks at time. Jesus said, night is coming when no man can work. What's his point? Well, from his perspective, he knew he wasn't going to be on this earth very long, and he had to do what needed to be done in a timely fashion. So there are lots of time-sensitive things that are going to come out in the biblical text as we're reading through the book of Isaiah, and they come into play here. So the timing is right. These things are going to come to fruition during this time. Moses is going to be the one who's going to lead them out. So after the actual Exodus, the departure, and the whole model of Exodus as being a major picture of redemption can't be missed. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and the sea, 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Well, they weren't literally baptized into Christ for the remission of sins, but there's a model there. They were delivered from oppression and bondage. Moses was the savior-like character that led them out. And so you have this model, this paradigm, this pattern that the crossing of the Red Sea represents when you come into the New Testament as it relates to baptism. And so there are lots of models like that that we're going to see as you go through biblical history and also when you get into the context of the book of Isaiah. So they're going to wander in the wilderness. Now, how long did it take for them to get to Mount Sinai? They were there within the second month. How long were they there? The rest of the first year into the beginning of the second year. And so, how long did it take for them after they left there to get to the borders of Canaan? Within 2 months. Well, how come they didn't take the land of Canaan 2 months after that? Because somebody didn't believe God. So God sent the spies into the land, one representative from each of the tribes, and they saw the giants that were in the land. They saw men carrying clusters of grapes so large that they had them on poles between their shoulders, which is kind of immense to think about it. And they looked at those men, said they were giants in the land, and they looked at themselves and said, we're grasshoppers compared to them. We can't do this. And Joshua and Caleb said, we're well able to do it. Let's go up at once and possess it. But the 10 tribes convinced the people, let's not do this. And God says, okay, you're going to be punished. And then everybody was ready to do what God wanted, only it was too late. They didn't take God at his word when his word was initially given. And so they're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Now it's during this time, at the beginning of the Exodus, that Sinai, Mount Sinai is there. Moses receives the law. We see rebellious people multiple times along the way. But at the beginning of Sinai, until they get into the land, the law is already given. The law of Moses is already given. What was it about? Well, the beginning of the law, have no other gods before me. Don't take my name in vain. All those things all the way down to the last commandment was, watch what you think. And so that law was already in effect. So here's a law for a nation that doesn't have a land yet because they didn't do what God wanted them to do when God asked them to do it. So the beginning of the nation from the standpoint of occupying land was forestalled for 40 years. A lot of messages that are going to be involved in that later. So they get into the conquest of Canaan. That's the next period of time. And that's going to start during the days of Joshua. But technically, though they drive out most of the people in the land, they don't drive everybody out of the land. And that's going to come back to haunt them. So if you look in the closing chapters, closing verses of Joshua 21 and Joshua 23, it says every promise that God gave with reference to the inhabitants of the land had been fulfilled. There were pockets that weren't fulfilled. Indeed, Jerusalem wasn't completely ridded of all the Jebusites until the time of David. That's going to be many years later. So now you have a very unique period of time. All right. After the period of conquest, which may have lasted 50 to 60 years, we're going to be near the end of Joshua's life, the beginning of the book of Judges. Joshua's going to die in the second chapter. And we see an ad hoc system of governing that's going to be in place for the next few hundred years. And that's the period of Judges. And the word judge makes it sound like they wore black robes and they worked in a courtroom. And though they did make judicial decisions like that sometimes, more often than not, they were judges to judge the enemies of God who were oppressing God's people, most notably the Philistines during this period of time. In fact, it was so bad, the Philistines were very progressive people, worked metal arts better than the Egyptians, than the children of Israel did at one point. And at one point, you couldn't even have farming implements sharpened unless you went to the Philistines to do it. That's how much control they had. If you see what about Gideon becoming the judge, he was secretly developing his crops in a wine press and out of the ordinary way because of the Philistine oppression. So the judges judged not just for Israel, but against the nations that were oppressing them. So we're going to zip through that very quickly, and we get to the period that's going to be most important for what we're looking at, and that's the period of the United Kingdom. We already talked about Saul. Already talked about David, and we already talked about Solomon, that United Kingdom. So United Kingdom here has nothing to do with Great Britain, all right? So we're not talking about the British Isles, but when the kingdom was united, which entails that at some point it's going to be divided. That's going to come next. So during that 120-year period or so, for 40, Saul, David, and Solomon, the kingdoms united, and it's going to be divided. And the impact, the division, is going to have everything to do with what Isaiah had to deal with, and what Jeremiah had to deal with, and all the other prophets. Because most of those prophets were dealing with a people and a period in time in which the kingdom was already divided. Already divided. So the kingdom's going to divide roughly, 850, 900. And Isaiah's going to come on the scene roughly 750 or so. And so the kingdom's going to divide at the time that I've got here is 920 BC. And those are all approximate dates. So it's going to be another 150, 160 years or so before Isaiah is going to be a prophet. And so he is dealing with the consequences some very egregious sins that had occurred before that. So what brings about the division? Solomon was a very wise king, very rich king, and initially a very righteous king. I say initially, because as you read through the books of Kings and Chronicles, you see he married many wives, and he allowed his wives to influence him to be involved in support of, if not actually committing, idolatry himself. How so? Many of his marriages were political. He married, the daughter of so-and-so in order to form a political alliance. But some of those women that he married were involved in the worship of foreign gods. And he actually financed the construction of their places of worship. And so this is where God says, I'm going to divide the kingdom. But God does something interesting. This is another time factor. And this is not the only time. He says, I'm not going to divide the kingdom now during Solomon's life, for the sake of his father David. So he doesn't do it then. There's a time factor involved, but he's going to do it. So after that, Rehoboam is going to become king. And it's during Rehoboam's time that there is a rebellion against the kingdom, still united at this point, because of the impressive taxes that Solomon imposed. So Solomon's wealthy, but Solomon didn't work for a living. Solomon got money brought to him because of his armies and because of the tribute and because of the taxations and other factors that were involved. Solomon was wealthy and the kingdom became wealthy. David was as well, but not to the extent that Solomon was. But the taxation was oppressive. And so when the people went to Rehoboam and said, you need to cut back on the taxes, and he was counseled to do so by the wiser older man, but the younger man said, no, don't do that, make it even worse. And so he said, you in effect haven't seen anything yet. And so they were going to increase the period of taxation and the kingdom split. So here's what's going on when Isaiah is a prophet and Jeremiah and most of the prophets that you see in the biblical text. The kingdom is divided. And the northern kingdom initially is going to be ruled by Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. There's another Jeroboam later, the second, but not the same Jeroboam. And he institutes a false system of worship. He sets up idols at Dan, and he sets up idols in Bethel, which are not too far from Jerusalem. And he says, it's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. These are your gods that deliver you from the land of Egypt. And in doing so, he made Israel the sin. There's not one righteous king listed in the northern kingdom. That division exists when Isaiah is a prophet. And that division is not only going to exist, but it's going to go away, because after the United Kingdom, the divided kingdom, there's going to be Judah alone. Why Judah alone? Because the northern kingdom goes into captivity. Samaria, the capital city, also known as Sebaste, was conquered in 722-723 BC, and they go into captivity. And that's just about to happen during the time of Isaiah. And so the reason why we've whirlwinded through all this period of history is to get to the point of saying all this stuff has already gone on when Isaiah becomes a prophet. During the times of the kings, the four kings that he serves in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 1. God's still sitting on the throne in Isaiah 6, but you've got kings that are coming and going and lots of troubles that's going on. Now, I'm going to stop there and not go any further than that in the chart. And I want to talk about some other things that are developing outside of Israel. All right, if you had a map, and I'm not going to put one on the screen now, but if you had a map and you looked at the land of Palestine, and you compared it to a state in the United States, what state most likely represents it from the standpoint of what it looks like in geographically, but also its rough size? How big do you think it is? Let me just tell you this. It's not as big as Alaska. It's not as big as Texas. It's not as big as California. Those are the largest states. It's not as big as any one of those. It's more close in size to the state of New Jersey, which means it's probably 60 to 70 miles wide, east to west, at its greatest point, and maybe 125 to 150 miles north and south. It's not a very big place. But the other thing that's interesting is the dynamic of things that are going on around it. Israel is not an island, you know, like Great Britain was for a long time. They've got Ireland and Scotland and Wales and all that, but you know, most of Great Britain, the England part of it, it was the larger part. It didn't have that kind of, you know, freedom and water protecting it. It's not like the United States with the Pacific and Atlantic. We do have borders with countries on the north, Canada, and to our south, Mexico. And so, but we're protected because of the way we are. But Israel, the land of Palestine, is surrounded by all kinds of other nations. Right? Tyre and Sidon, the Phoenicians, and the Philistines that are over on the Mediterranean, Assyria, all these nations that are around them, the Moabites, the Ammonites, some of whom are related to them religiously, genetically, genealogically, because of the sons of Lot and the daughters and so forth, that story. And so they've got lots of nations around them. So in addition to everything that's going on religiously that the prophets have to deal with, they've got to deal with what's going on militarily and politically. Egypt was a constant thorn in the flesh. Syria and Assyria, Syria, Damascus, often a thorn in the flesh. And the Babylonians later are going to be a thorn in the flesh. So all of these things are going on politically and economically around them. And so even though the northern kingdom is going to go into captivity in about 722 BC, during the time that the Assyrians make inroads against the northern kingdom, they also took some of the cities in the southern kingdom captive. So wait a minute, they didn't fall for 116 years later. That doesn't mean they weren't threatened. And during the days of Isaiah that we're going to get into, there were representatives of the Assyrian king, Rabshakeh, and all those guys that came to the city of Jerusalem during the time of Hezekiah and threatened to stop them. Says, we have shut you up like a bird in a cage. So wait a minute, they're not going to be destroyed by the Assyrians. No, they're not. But they are oppressed by the Assyrians. So Isaiah is dealing with whether or not the nation of Israel is faithful religiously to the Old Testament promise that was made to Abraham and to the law of Moses, and whether or not they are living righteously in the land, that they're having a positive impact on the nations around them rather than being threatened by the nations around them. So that's all going on as well. So before we go any further, you know, we're not going to do anything more on that one. To get down to the point where we're close to where Isaiah and other prophets are going to be prophesying. And if you look off to the side, when you see the divided kingdom, you'll start seeing the names of the prophets. Let's see if I can make this a little bigger and slide this over for those who are in the class. All right, went too far this way. So when you look over here, in this period, you can see some of the prophets are mentioned. Jonah, Joel, Amos, Micah, named these prophets. They are serving during this period of time. So there's that swath of time. That's before the northern kingdom goes into captivity. This is when the southern kingdom comes into captivity. So look, all these prophets here, here, and on these lines, all those prophets are prophesying during this period of time. These are the only prophets that lap over into the period during the exile. Jeremiah borders before and after the exile, and Ezekiel and Daniel are prophets in the exile. And so prophets are usually described in two different ways. They're described as whether or not they are a northern or a southern prophet. That's the people they prophesy to, not where they're from. Because sometimes a man from the south would go and prophesy in the north. And so they're either northern or southern, that is, they prophesy to the nation of Israel in the north or the nation of Judah. And they're also categorized according to time. Were they before the exile, pre-exilic, during the exile? Three, technically only two, Ezekiel and Daniel and Jeremiah bordering that. Or were they prophets after the exile? And if you look at the very bottom of the chart, you see the names that are mentioned there, Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And so those are the post-exilic prophets. So most of the prophets are prophesying in and around this general period of time during which Isaiah is going to serve as a prophet. All right, any questions or comments? Let's see what we've got here. Let's take another short break, and then we'll come back and wrap up in a few minutes and get into some new material.